CLU President Chris Kimball and I recently sat down to chat about the future of higher education and massive open online courses, or MOOCs. Inspired by a recent New York Times op-ed by Thomas Friedman, we started with the question of whether MOOCs were really the future of higher ed, or were just overhyped.
I'm going to be trying to play both sides of the street, typical historian here, yes?
Yeah.
And certainly, MOOCs as an expression of online learning are changing the game a little bit. And they will have implications, some of which we maybe start to see, some of which we have no clue yet. As you know, I'm not somebody who's against technology. I think there is a place for it.
You're here doing a podcast.
I'm doing a podcast. You're sitting there with a laptop. I mean, nobody would have known what this was 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
At the same time, I do think a lot of the MOOC stuff is overhyped, or the assumptions that's going to lead to this total transformation are overstated, and it's because they intersect with other worries like the cost of higher education.
Which is a really big issue.
Yeah. Now, what people mean is the price.
Right.
No one really asks how much does it cost to educate a student.
Which is much higher than the price.
Yeah. I mean, here it takes donors to make up the difference. In public institutions, it's taxpayers make up the difference. So people could be saying, well, why does it cost so much to educate a student? A lot of it is it's an older method where you have faculty professionals working with small groups. And MOOCs do blow that up, no doubt about it.
Right.
But that's really a separate question from why are people paying what they're paying for, which is the political issue that's out there. So I think there are some folks who go, okay, I think I'm having to pay too much for my or my kids' education.
Right.
There's something wrong. It must be these highly paid professors.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
But you get that when, in fact, they're compared to other professionals with similar or lesser doctors, lawyers, who make much more.
Right.
So it's not that.
Right.
So on the MOOCs, I think we got to be careful of not assuming they're solving one problem when I think they may be dealing with some other things.
Right.
If I could just keep going. Again,
yeah.
It's not that I'm against them.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that, but I think there have to be a couple cautions.
Right.
And we could maybe get into those in a minute if you want. But
I was just thinking that their system of delivery of education is assumes something particular about the way people learn things, right? I mean, the sage on the stage, now he's videotaped,
yeah.
Right? Or she's videotaped.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to assume that content delivery method actually works the way that, you know, you assume it to work. Whereas what we do here, what I do here at CLU is a lot more interactive than that. I mean, isn't that one of the...
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's kind of ironic because there's been this whole movement to say, you know, lecturing's bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be interactive, and we don't want the sage on the stage. We want the guide on the side.
Right.
Now, we've all had great lecturers.
Right.
And lousy ones. There are people who are great at doing discussion and some that are lousy at it.
Right.
There are some disciplines that work better in a lecture than others. You know, there's no one-size-fits-all. So it's
right.
Kind of ironic. We're really going back to the oldest, most traditional model
right.
of the big expert. Instead of being in the room in front of 10 people, 100 people, 1,000 people, now they're online talking to those people, none of whom they know.
I like what you're saying there, that in academia, we think that we've evolved in some way by making our pedagogy much more interactive.
Mm-hmm.
And being much more careful about how students learn. And yet, this new technological experience privileges the old way of doing it.
Absolutely. And I would say it's a return to the industrial model.
It is industrial,
you know,
right?
You got the person at the top doing a mass educational process.
Right.
One person speaking to 30,000 or whatever it is.
Right.
Well, for big universities, and we both attended them,
yep.
So we're not being hypercritical, one of the ways they make their finances work is you have a lecturer go in for 250 people.
Right.
Or 1,000 in some cases.
Right.
Right?
Well, after about 200, what difference does it make?
It does.
Yeah. There's a certain cutoff, right?
But that's a way, it's kind of big box retailing education.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe that it's simply the professor talking, means that students are learning.
Right.
Or in fact, you don't care if they're learning or not, but they're there to get the information to it.
Right.
If you believe in that model,
right,
then this is simply extrapolating it out even more, and the professor only gets to do it once. You don't
right.
have to keep paying them multiple terms. You just put the tape in again and run it.
Well, so copyright and who owns the content, those questions actually really need to be answered.
Oh, a huge question.
Too. But one thing, as you said, that it, you know, the MOOCs seem to, or this sort of online model seems to speak to, one problem that it speaks to is the cost, the price, or if you want to put it. Is there another way to bend cost curves, as people are talking about, in higher ed? Or are we just in for, you know, continual sort of exponential growth in cost and price?
Lately been reading some stuff. There was a book, it's now a year or two old, Why Does College Cost So Much?
Okay, right.
Which they, and the it's an econ, a couple of economists did it, and they said really the subtitle should have been, and why is the price so high, distinguishing between the two.
Yeah.
And they draw on this economist, I think started working in the 60s, on why do symphony orchestra tickets cost so much.
Interesting.
And the basic argument, as I understand it, is that you're talking about labor-intensive industries, okay? And whether or not professors are paid a lot relative to doctors and lawyers, the point is they are being paid, and they are not like assembly line things or production of laptops which or iPhones, which can keep coming down in price. At some point,
they're a unique mode of labor.
A unique mode of labor that's always going to have costs associated with. And generally, you want to keep paying those people more every year, and their benefits should get a little better over time. So those are just going to go up. And, and the argument is that's not going to change.
Right.
Just like you can't mass produce the LA Philharmonic.
Right.
Right. You got these very talented, specialized people, of whom there are only a few in the world,
right,
and it's not going to work any other way. Now, what they're also arguing is, look, the kind of automobile you can get now with all the things you have it in dollars adjusted for inflation is much better than you used to be able to get. This,
laptop.
I mean, there's more computing power in that than what put a man on the moon,
right?
And the price has come down,
right?
And so, in some ways, they're arguing people really. Well, maybe another way to put it. If you say college prices are this much above CPI growth, right? They're above inflation. Well, that's working off an average. So that means there are other things that are below.
Right.
That's how you get the average.
Right.
Right? So the kind of argument is we're paying relatively less in other things, so affordability hasn't changed all that much.
Right.
For education.
Right.
The absolute dollars have, but the relative impact on people's income, if you will, hasn't changed that much. You go, why is it such a hot-button issue now? Well, there's no doubt the recession has dislocated
right.
some things. But one of the other arguments is folks are making decisions to spend on things other than education.
Right.
The family that is saying, oh, I can't afford $20,000 to send my kid to CLU.
Right.
is paying $5 a day for a coffee.
Right. So not only is consumer price index something that you need to take into account to do this math, you've got to take into account the affordability of other things. And college is still as good of a deal or as bad of a deal, or whatever you want to put it, as it sort of ever was.
And it's distorted by the, you know, Harvard charges $70,000.
Right.
That doesn't mean every school's charging $70,000.
Right.
And it also doesn't mean everybody's paying...
Right.
The going rate. And so there are, the headlines don't reflect the reality. Just like, oh, so-and-so has taken on $150,000 in debt to go to college.
But the other side of that, though, is that it's the cost is still going to, the price is still going to look even more absurd down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that.
Yeah,
right?
Probably.
So, I mean, it's really hard to... If that is true, how do you educate a populace on that and say, well...
Oh, it's hard. I agree that the educational campaign around why does higher education cost, why is the price so high?
It's a tricky...
Is not well said. And the fact that we have our sticker price here at Kalu, like all the schools do, but hardly anybody's paying that.
Right.
That's a, how do you communicate that? We don't do that very well. But that is a problem.
But it's a problem. And then something else, you know, some other mode of delivery could come in and take advantage of that, right? And that's where we are with the MOOC. So then what if you were to run the campaign, what is the value then? So forget the cost, forget the price. What is the value of higher education? At least in the American
system.
Can I
tackle that from a couple directions?
You know, you're the boss.
There's a kind of clear, sort of practical, typically American kind of thing. I've heard some people I've worked with over the years say, look, the cost of an undergraduate education for most people is about the cost of a pretty good car.
Mm-hmm.
In a year. And that hasn't changed for 40 years.
A really good car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here the average student, undergrad student, is paying about 17, 18.
A year.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
So the cost per year is the cost of a good car.
And then they're saying, you know, you go back in the 60s, it might have been 4,000.
But that was the cost.
Okay. So they're saying, you know, roughly there's an equivalence there. So inflation can distort the perception of things.
Right.
But that's a pretty limited argument. I mean, you're going to sit there and do that with economists or finance people who are trying to sort it out. I think the real argument is about, A, what is education?
Yep.
And then B, what do we believe is, if not the only best way to do it, at least a way to do it that we believe is valuable.
Right.
So first, and I'll come back to the MOOCs, it's very interesting to me the assumption that you or I could sign up for one of these courses, absorb all this information, and do that enough times, enough of these courses, that at the end we are educated.
Right. Well, and that's something that Friedman says. It's not how many years you put into it. At the end of the day, the market has to test what you got out of
right.
the process.
Right, and I want to come back to that in a minute, too, if I could.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's this smorgasbord thing. I mean, you know, I like history. So, gee, I might do a MOOC on history of the Ottoman Empire because I don't know much about it and I've been trying to learn about it. Or history of the Mughals or something like that.
Right.
And I'm sure I would get a lot out of that. Reading, listening, and so forth. But would that make me a historian? I don't think so. Where is the idea that you'd simply accumulate enough of these learning experiences and then the sum total means you're prepared? Now, I do think, and this is where I'm going to get into campus politics, so I'm in trouble here.
Well, this is where it gets juicy for the podcast. I mean,
yeah, but I mean, I think that's one of the risks in the way we do our general education here. Mm-hmm. The core is without the interdisciplinary blends, without a kind of capstone. Not in the major. Majors do it,
right?
But you know, where does a student take their general education and kind of bring it together, as opposed to you've done this number of units and this number of different disciplines, and therefore you are educated.
Well, and that's something that that book, Academically Adrift, a few years ago brought up, is that how do you quantify or even test what a student has learned over X number of years in college? So you're saying there needs to be, you would like a sort of culmination experience?
Yeah, or I could see it working in a capstone in a major where there might be an opportunity. And I know it would change the nature of them and add work and so forth. But my opportunity to say, hey, draw on something you learned in history, in philosophy, in biology. How do those perspectives inform how you're dealing with this problem in religion, let's just say.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be onerous. You're not necessarily going back and testing material they had before. But have they really been able to draw from different disciplinary lenses?
Well,
and apply those.
If you studied, you know, history and you were able to do that, well, you kind of are a historian at the end of that process if you can articulate, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not a historian who can get hired at a university, but you've you know imbibed or you know become conversant in the discipline's methods.
Yeah, I could see that within the major, but if I've also had this education where I've gotten some theology, gotten some music.
Right.
In some chemistry.
So make that capstone experience for the broad-based education.
Then, to me, that would put the MOOCs then sort of morally out of business because you're saying it's not just learning in these particular course units but the bringing them together.
Right.
I mean, it's what you do with course material interactively.
Right.
You take what they've absorbed, you hope, and try to do something with it.
Well, it's almost as if, though, I mean, as a teacher speaking, it's almost as if there is no absorption until they do something with it. Right.
You could say it's memorization.
Right. Right? Like, yeah. So until you are able to utilize the knowledge that you have, you couldn't call that critical thinking.
I would agree.
Right. Yeah. You don't really know it until you can show that you can do something.
I agree. There's a big difference between having a student sit there and read or listen to something.
Yeah.
And then be able to talk to them and see if they actually grasp and not just repeating the words back.
Right. So it seems like what you're saying, though, that not that MOOCs, quote-unquote, could go out of business, but they might have a role. Like, online lecturing format might have a role to play, but it would only be one role in a larger educational process. So technological, you know, expansion of the way that this information is shared plays one important but still limited role.
Yeah, I think it will have a role, does have a role, whether it requires a star professor with 30,000 people, or David Marcy filming at night for students that look, and then they...
You mean a star professor filming at night?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our star professor filming at night. Very good. Of course, that's what I mean.
I want to make sure he hears that.
Yeah. There are different ways of getting there, but I think the value piece is making connections.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to do when you're just the recipient of information. Now, you could say, and I guess some of the MOOCs are, you know, you've got study halls online and so forth. I agree.
Right.
Those work, too.
Right.
At some point, somebody's going to start getting paid for those.
Right.
And then that means the students are going to start having to pay for them.
Right.
And then you're back down into that whole price cost.
So the nature of education, the nature of the way that we think about knowledge is such that... things might change, but they're probably going to stay the same in certain ways.
I think so.
That's really interesting.
And obviously, I mean, I've got a bias. I wouldn't be here if I didn't think things like face-to-face interaction with faculty are important.
Right.
Are they the only thing? No. Can you have good online conversations with people? Yes. But is that... can you just do that without the face? Maybe some people can.
Yeah.
And bless them for it, and their institutions can do it.
Right.
But the value added is a student can talk to you.
Yeah.
And I think many of us, even young people, maybe even more younger people today, want a sense that I'm actually talking to a human being.
Yeah, I mean,
look them in the eye.
There's enough sort of alienation through technology and the rest of our culture but that's also an interesting question, right? Does that become the norm, or does that create a kind of disenchantment with technology that makes you want to go back to the old way of doing things?
I'm entirely speculating here based on, you know, kind of an end of two teenagers and that sort of thing.
Right.
That my sense is that they're much less interested in the MOOC thing.
Right.
They like technology. I mean, they're always texting, no doubt about it. But in terms of learning, they're still looking for that personal...
yeah.
connection.
Right.
Now, they may not want to do homework and all that kind of. Those are different pathologies that have a history to
it.
But I think it's more people like you and me. Okay, I'm busy. I'm not going to go enroll somewhere.
Right.
I'm not going to go back to school. But gee, I can do something online.
Or on my drive, I can click on a great course.
Right.
And pick up some knowledge about XYZ.
Yeah, somebody from Harvard is doing, like I said, the history of the Ottomans after Suleiman. Okay.
Right.
Maybe I want to do that.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
But that's not...
but that's only to history nerds like us.
Yeah, right.
Now, but what about the residential experience? I mean, do you think that that's going to be under siege? I mean, how much does that contribute to the cost price thing? And where does it fit into the value question?
Yeah, I think the residential thing is really important.
Yeah.
But it's clear that the great, great majority, even just of undergraduates, are not getting that.
Right now.
Here and elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of that is the perception of the expense associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of reality, but I think people often understate what it costs.
Yeah.
Either students to say, let's get an apartment together.
Right.
And then pretty soon they're all buying groceries, only a third of which ever get eaten.
Right.
And then they end up going out. I think it often costs some more.
Well, the economy of scale thing is funny, though, because it has two sides, right? Like, when campuses started having to add bowling alleys just to compete, that was one way in which it showed great inefficiency in the system. But, you know, a mess hall is the great efficiency.
Boom. Well, it's interesting. Somebody just did a study, I want to say within the last month, that was in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, Inside Higher Ed. You may have seen it. Showing that actually, if you're looking to recruit more students and better students, you probably should be putting money into the bowling alleys and all that stuff and not into academic programs as much.
Yeah, right.
And they, you know, the people looking at it, that was not the result they wanted to get.
Right.
That's what they were coming back with, that the bells and whistles matter. That's pretty discouraging.
That is discouraging.
Stuff.
Yeah.
But I do think there is some truth in that we live in an experience kind of economy where what people are often buying is an experience.
Right.
I think you see that with the malls now. I think probably because of online, much of retail is just never going to recover.
Mm.
Right? So to me, the strip malls are in big trouble. The big malls where you're getting entertainment, you're going there to see and be seen, they'll probably be okay because of the experience.
And
it's not the buy-in.
You feel luxurious just being there. So they provide a certain kind of cachet of...
Well, look at the two movie theaters that have opened up here in the recession.
They're amazing.
Movie Co. and then the...
The one in Westlake.
Yeah.
Where...
Total high-end.
Uh-huh.
Total high-end. No, nobody's building cut-rate movies. Now, you thought, in the worst economy since the 30s.
Yeah.
Well, if somebody's going to invest in movie theaters, it's going to be cut rate, discount stuff, get people... No, high end. And I think it's that experience thing. People can watch the movie at home.
Right.
But hey, let's go out and pretend we're rich people and do it. And so, I think higher ed gets a little of that, too.
So in terms of our campus here, what bells and whistles do you want to invest in? And what of the... You know, what you're sort of... Not really calling the substantive stuff, but
you could say the dining commons is a bells and whistles thing.
Mm-hmm.
There, I think there are other pieces to it, a modern kitchen facility that can do a better range of foods than we can do now.
And that's better for the workers.
But yeah,
right.
That's important. I think it also has the opportunity to create a campus social center.
Yeah.
Around things like coffee, for one thing, that we don't... I mean, the Centrum is kind of nice, but it's small and it's not ideal.
And hopefully also a place where people can sit and have those discussions.
At some length.
Outside of class.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And again, the Centrum does that, but it's not... During the day, generally, but at night, you know, you got to sit over by the fire pit. It's a little chilly. And inside, there's often not enough seats.
Right.
It's noisy. So it's not conducive. You want to sit for an hour and a half talking about...
MOOCs?
A book, MOOCs, or whatever. and so we're hoping that would do that. So I'd argue there's some community benefits beyond the bells and whistles.
Right.
But there's no doubt we want something that's more presentable to prospective students than what we have now.
Right.
But then the main building things are the science and then the creative arts.
Right.
Again, both of which should be eye-grabbing and attention-getting, but they're really to promote teaching and learning, faculty working with students.
Mm-hmm.
Student-faculty research in the sciences, painter sitting there with painting students in a studio that actually works for painting, that has light and all of those kinds of things.
And if you got a place to showcase theater arts with a stage, then,
imagine.
I mean, all of those things raise the profile of the university.
Right.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I would argue... that the people, you know, before my time, but who said build this athletic stuff over here will get better students coming, whether or not they're athletes or not. I think they've actually, that's sort of been proven to be the case.
Yeah.
That even the academically oriented student kind of looks at that and goes, wow, this must be a serious place. They got new
stuff. It's nice. I went over
nice.
And I shot hoops at the, in the, what's the main gym called? Or
The Gilbert Arena.
The arena.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I've never shot around there before.
Yeah, I don't think actually I have. So.
It felt D1 or whatever, you know. It was really nice.
Yeah.
So,
could I attack the MOOCs on something else
that
you alluded to before?
Yeah, go for it.
It's in the Friedman article, and I've heard, seen, and read in some other places, which is that we're moving from student seat time, to content. Knowledge and ability to demonstrate, you know, what outcomes to use the assessment language.
Because right now the assessment model is what, Carnegie hours, right?
Right.
How many hours have these students had contact
right.
in a way that is, you know, educationally yeah. productive.
As opposed to what Friedman says, and I think with some correctness, is the move to what did you actually learn?
What do you know?
Okay, and I think that movement is happening, and I think there's a lot of good things to be said for it.
Right.
But what's so ironic is that while we're hearing the MOOCs are going to help do that,
yeah.
right, the federal government, through the Department of Education, is moving ever more to the Carnegie hours. Hmm. I mean, you remember here we had the deal with TWEAC and ADEP to get a few more contact hours in
right.
to conform to the Department of Ed's new guidelines.
So you can get loans and financing. And,
right.
right.
But so you have the Department of Education, which is much more intrusive than it used to be, mm-hmm. saying you've got to have this many hours of seat time or
right.
else.
Right.
Okay. That's run entirely, the logic there is completely opposite from what this is about.
Right.
So from a policy level, on the one hand, I hear policy makers saying, we got to move to outcomes and MOOCs will help us do it, etc. Then you got other policy makers saying, you got to conform to seat time standards. Which is it?
Right.
I think there's incoherence around, there's a massive critique of higher ed following on the one of K-12 that's right. been around for a generation.
Right.
But utter incoherence about what should be done to improve it.
Well, it seems in the short term, the easiest solution for that to resolve is that the seat time wins, right? Because it's the easiest thing to
easiest
quantify.
Easiest to measure. Yeah.
But do you think in the long run, there will that the tension between those two will be more productive and come out with a better outcome to test these things? Or
yeah.
does seat time trump?
Here's my... I guess I have enough pessimism or cynicism about the power of federal authority to impose the easiest thing to quantify
uh-huh.
on people. And, uh-huh. you know, I mean, I come out of the humanities, and so I don't believe that all experience and all knowledge can be converted to a number.
Right.
But that is the dominant view in our culture.
Right.
Right. Whether it's economics to assessment or whatever.
Right.
So philosophically, I feel that we've kind of lost that battle.
Right.
You know, people now say data, they mean a number.
Right.
As opposed to a portion of a text.
Right.
That's data too. But that we've lost, I feel that we've lost that battle.
Yeah.
So that's one reason I think anything that leads to a convenient number, like seat time, is going to have the upper hand.
Hmm.
At the same time, if we can pay attention to what students actually learn and leave with, whether or not we can measure it, whether or not we can convert that measurement into a number is less important. But if we pay attention to it, then I think we're doing the right thing and we'll still have something to talk about. And that's what you do. I mean, that's what our faculty do in general. That's why they're here.
Right.
Is you actually care. It's not just walk in, talk, leave.
I actually just hit my podcast and I bounced.
Yeah, you're gone. I had a colleague at a previous institution who would sit in his class
yeah.
with the students and watch a video of himself teaching.
He was ahead of the curve now.
Well, you know, he was so postmodern, he didn't even know it.
Was he just sitting there and being like, wow, I really nailed that?
Yeah, I don't know. Or maybe he's saying, oh, that's not so good. But, you know, so they'd sit down and the students say, okay, let's watch this lecture on this, whatever the subject for the day was that I did 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well,
I don't think that's the ethic here. And that the faculty like you and your colleagues believe that what students leave with matters, and that's right. why when they don't leave with it, it's so frustrating.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, in order to leave with it, you've got to practice a certain kind of discipline, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the professor needs to practice that discipline, but definitely the students
student
need to. So, yeah, that's where our frustrations
well,
often come up.
Discipline, I think there also has to be humility.
Mm-hmm.
Both humility in the face of expertise.
Yeah.
Not that expertise conveys political authority or anything like that.
Right.
But if you have an opportunity to learn from somebody who knows more than you do about the subject, recognize that.
Well, it's also the humility also for the collective, not just for the authority of the professor, because one thing that I see in my classes is that students, I mean, you know that cliche that, oh, I learned more than your students did, the professors always say?
I don't believe that.
Well, sometimes it ends up being true because when you throw ideas out and you throw questions out there into the ethos of a sort of seminar style class, what you come up with is greater than some of the parts.
Yeah. Sometimes. Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And saying a student should have humility in learning doesn't mean they can't question.
Right.
I mean, they should. That's what you want. I mean, right. Isn't that what we always want? Is for them to challenge in a thoughtful way.
Yeah. Give me that student who's hungry to question.
Yeah. But also to recognize that it's not just Fox News where somebody's yelling real loud and you can yell at them whether or not they're informed or you're informed.
Right. You know?
That it's not an entirely intellectually democratic environment. Mm-hmm. The professor is in there because the professor is professing a discipline they've devoted their life to.
Yeah.
They could be wrong, and they're going to be wrong about some things.
Right.
There are areas where they need to be stretched. Right. But it's not like they're just somebody who happens to be in there killing an hour of seat time or whatever it is.
Right.
And I sometimes am struck by, it's not just students, in our culture, that it's like, oh, what do they know?
Right.
I did, 30 years in that field, but I know as much as they do because I have a gut feeling that they're wrong.
Right.
Come on, where's the evidence? Why do you feel that way?
It's probably the mistaking of information and data, like you were talking about, for knowledge and wisdom, right?
Yeah, another anecdote at the equivalent kind of our honors banquet at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Different institution, of course. Faculty member was talking about the difference between data, information, knowledge, and wisdom, and kind of went through the whole thing. It's really a good talk. And the MC, who was a recent alum who did stand-up, and I don't think this is meant to be funny, but what she said when he was done was, thanks for the good information. It's like, oh, man.